Hey, everybody, and welcome to The Brand Called You. So listen, I have to start my coffee. I have to start my morning every day with coffee. I have to do it. I'm obsessed with good coffee, but I have to be honest with you. I think that up until meeting my recent guest, the guest that we're going to have today, I think my choices for what coffee I was going to be drinking were limited by how much they cost at the grocery store. You know, I'd walk in, I'd see what was on sale. It never occurred to me that coffee was a metaphor for so many other things. But our guest today, Dean Sycon, has really changed my view on that. Dean is a fascinating man. He owns a coffee company called Dean's Beans, which he started after working as a decade as an indigenous rights lawyer, an environmental attorney. And he had this mission. He wanted to use coffee as a vehicle for positive social, economic, and ecologic change. And his company does just that. They design and fund projects in partnership with growers all over the world. And they actually return a percentage of the profits to the growers as a social equity premium. He's received so many awards over the years, including a best practices recognition from the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations and a sustainability award from the Specialty Coffee Association America, among others. He's also wears multi-hats. He's been a research fellow at Woods Hole in Massachusetts, the famous Oceanographic Institute. He's been a senior Fulbright scholar and a Yale Law School visiting fellow. And as if that wasn't enough, he's an author. He's written two books now, Java Trekker, Dispatches from the World of Fair Trade Coffee, and his most recent book, a novel called Finding Home, which is set in Hungary during the Holocaust and based loosely on his own family experience. So I couldn't be more happy and more intrigued to sort of welcome you, Dean. I'm so happy to have you. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
So, you know, you have a video on your website, and it intrigued me because the first thing that you hear is you say, you know, coffee isn't just good, it's great. And then you go on to explain why coffee can be so much greater than just the taste of it and the price of it. And I'm so intrigued with that. I mean, tell me what you mean by that.
Well, you know, if you widen your lens on your coffee, okay, and you look inside your cup, what do you see? If you go deep into the cup, you see all the issues of globalization being played out, women's rights, indigenous rights, the environment, war and peace, globalization economics, all of that is being played out inside that cup of coffee. So you have a choice when you buy that coffee and when you drink that coffee to either accept what is or to say, wow, I want this coffee to reflect my values. You know, not all products you can do that with, because like, you know, rice, for example, it's what they call a fungible commodity. It means it's totally interchangeable. You don't know where it comes from. You don't know what farm it comes from. Clothing's a little better, but you still don't know quite what factory in Bangladesh it was made in. But coffee, now we know exactly who grow it, exactly what the conditions of their lives are, about their economics. And so you can make a statement. You know, it's not just this generic, I want to be a good guy. This is like, you can really make a statement and really make a difference in the choice you make with coffee. And that's why I say it's not only the taste. Like, most coffee tastes pretty good. Okay, it does. But in order to be great coffee, I think it has to go further, and it has to really serve as many constituents as it can. That's the farmers, right? With really high prices to the farmers so they can stay on their land, development assistance to the farmers so that they can start to achieve their goals, and much more significantly, the self-esteem that our programs develop in the farmers. I'd love to talk about that in a little bit, because that's the key to what we do. But then on, and the environment, but then on the other side, the consumer. You just made the point. You can pay, and people are paying now, $30, $35 a pound for coffee, and they don't know it because they're buying it in 12-ounce, 10-ounce bags, right? So you don't quite, people don't quite compute that, oh, this is only $15. Yeah, but it's 10 ounces. So it's actually $22. You know, if you look at it per pound. Yeah,
we also don't know why we're paying the amount that we're paying, who's behind it. But I was curious, you were an indigenous lawyer prior. So obviously your interest in helping people globally was always there and locally. But did your work as an attorney in any way fuel this coffee chapter in your life? Like, did it give you the tools or the desire to do something perhaps more? I don't know. I wonder how your law practice informed this business.
Well, I wanted to become a lawyer. I grew up in the 1960s, high school. And so the Vietnam War was on, and I was very impressionable, obviously, high school kid. And I noticed that the challenges to the very bad government policy in fighting the war in Vietnam, the challenges were organized by lawyers, William Kunstler, all sorts of famous lawyers. They helped organize street protests. They organized court challenges. And I said, wow, if I want to be an effective participant in making this world a better place, which I do, I got to be a lawyer. And so I went to law school with that idea. Then I went and started practicing law with that idea. But I soon found that, pardon the pun, but I didn't have the constitution to be a good lawyer. I didn't like other lawyers. I didn't like being in a room with other lawyers. I didn't like all the paperwork. I didn't like the posturing. It wasn't about the search for the truth. It was about winning. So I knew that the tools I had gained as a lawyer were really, really important. And so I started to apply them to the environment and to indigenous peoples in the US and Canada for treaty rights, fighting hazardous waste facilities, fighting large-scale destructive mining. And that was really important and empowering to me, as well as useful to the people. So then here's how it started. I didn't know anything about coffee. I was giving a lecture at the University of Rhode Island on the causes of deforestation in Brazil, which are really about ownership of land, has nothing to do with cows, except that they allow you to own the land. So I was giving this lecture, and afterwards a professor came out of the audience and said, hey, I have a friend who has a cafe in Providence. Back then they called them coffee shops. And he knows that the people he buys from in Brazil, right where you're talking about, are poor, and they're not getting the benefit of the trade in coffee. And he wanted to know, maybe you could talk to him and help him figure out what to do. I met with the cafe owner, and I did a little research, and I quickly found out that 85-90% of all coffee farmers were indigenous peoples. So I said, oh, wow, well, I understand these populations. They're marginalized. They're not part of the decision making in the center of the country. They don't tend to speak the same language. They're slightly different culture. For example, in Latin America, the majority of farmers I work with do not speak Spanish. They speak indigenous languages. They can't understand Spanish. So they're out of the decision-making, you know, even on a regional level, right? And that's the way it is all over the world. So I already knew the population. And the second part of it was, there was no international development organization actually working in coffee villages. They were working in the countries, but not focused on the problems of these marginalized coffee villages way up in the mountains. So we started one. We started Coffee Kids, the world's first international development organization devoted to coffee. So my role in Coffee Kids in those early years was to go to the villages, meet the farmers, and start to develop programs that met their developmental needs, not mine, not some big organization in the United States, but their needs. And from having worked with indigenous communities for 10 years, I understood that process. So that was great. It was great charity. We went to the big coffee companies and said, give us some money. And then we took that money and we built a little well or whatever. It was very nice. But I came to realize over about 5 years that nothing was changing, because the companies were still paying lousy prices for the coffee. The people still didn't have the capacity to make their own decisions, but the companies were advertising to their customers, look at these wonderful things we're doing. Buy our coffee because we're good guys. And the consumer is getting the message, oh, No problem with the farmers and the environment because the companies are taking care of it. So the consumers are happily walking away ignorant to the fact that not only are they not changing things, they're helping to make it worse. So I decided, what am I going to do about this? I tried talking to companies at concerts and conferences and stuff, and all of a sudden I found the doors started closing. After being the poster child for development coffee, the doors started to close. So I thought, you know what, I got to do something about this. So I decided to start a company to model what I thought was an appropriate behavior pattern. And it was based on two things. First, would it be possible to pay farmers fair wages and fair prices for their coffee and still be profitable? Because the people in the coffee industry kept saying, you know, we'd love to contribute to your nonprofit, but you know, we don't really have any money. Wow, I found out that's not true. Coffee is probably one of the most profitable commodities in the world. The second thing was, okay, would it be possible for a company to engage in the development issues in those coffee villages in a meaningful way and still be profitable? So if I could do both those things and be profitable, I have a model. So that's what I started in 1993, Dean's Beans Organic Coffee. It was an experiment. I didn't know if it was going to work. It was an experiment, and I can tell you that for 30 years, Dean's Beans has grown incrementally every single year, nonstop, for 30 years, through economic downturns, through pandemics. We just keep growing step by step. Now, not trying to be Starbucks, so growth in and of itself is not a metric I use. To me, growth is the outcome of business done well. It's not the object of business. You know, I talk a lot, I lecture in business schools around the country and some internationally. And I always talk about the myths that you learn in business school. And one of the myths is that profit maximization is your primary focus and even legal obligation. Well, it's not. And so we've proven over 30 years, you can have a really successful business that serves everybody from the farmer to the environment to the consumer by giving them really low prices, what you're talking about.
Is part of that equation that you have to accept less profitability than others, other competitors?
Well, like, you know,
willing to accept a lower share of the pie.
Okay, so that's so interesting. I was given a lecture at Harvard Business School, the graduate program, 1 year. And a gentleman stood up and said, well, excuse me, all this is very nice, but what's your profit at the end of the year? What's your profit? And I thought about that, and I know what the figure is, but I thought, I know what the right answer to that is. I said, enough. He said, what does that mean? I said, well, we pay the farmers as much as we can. We keep the price as low as we can to the consumer so that anybody can buy our coffee, not just people with super disposable income. And we do all these other things. And at the end of the day, all the bills are paid. Everybody's happy. We've got profit sharing both for the customers and for the farmers and for the workers at Dean's Beans. I said, you know, and at the end of the day, we still have profit, like about, you know, 8-10% profit. But it's enough. You know, in my way of looking at the world, you know, that's profit to me. Is you've served all your constituents, you're making a good living, and you have some left over at the end of the year, and that to me is enough.
What were some of the like absolute unexpected horrible challenges that in dealing with these countries globally that you had all sorts of unexpected challenges? Undoubtedly, was there something that happened? I mean, can you maybe name one or two that you had to overcome?
The one I was surprised at that I didn't have to overcome are national and local governments. You would think the company comes to town with resources and they want to be involved. You would think everybody and their grandmother in the government would jump on that and basically try to get some corruption money and, you know, try to swing it so that it looks like it's supporting their government. Never. And I always wonder, what the heck? Why aren't they all over us? I'm glad. They're not, but why not? And I came to realize that we were doing in those regions what the government should be doing. We were doing healthcare programs. We were doing literacy programs. We were doing women's loan funds. We were doing water buffalo for ecological management programs. We were doing all this on our dime, and the government didn't have to provide those services to these really remote communities that they couldn't have cared less about, you know? And so it was odd, but it's actually worked to our benefit. Now, that's not true. In one country, Papua New Guinea, and also in Kenya, government people tried to horn in and really turn it to their advantage. And in Kenya, I actually did run into problems trying to go forward because I angered a minister so much that he got up at a public meeting and addressed the farmers and told them that I was there to rip them off and I was there to steal their money and he would protect them from me. And I'm like, what is he saying? What is he saying?
Why did you anger him?
Pardon? What did I do to anger him? So we were going, I wanted to go up to this remote village where we were going to meet with a bunch of farmers. And so the minister who knew I was there, the minister for cooperative development of all things, he came and said, oh, let me give you a ride up to the village. And I said, oh, okay, that's kind. This Mercedes pulls up, air-conditioned Mercedes pulls up in 100-degree Kenya, you know. So I get in the back seat of his leather-bound Mercedes, and I think, okay, well, here we go. So we're driving up there, and we pull off the main road, and we start going elsewhere. And I'm like, where are we going? He goes, oh, I just want to make a stop. We're making a stop at his farm. I mean, his farm with a palatial house on it. And he says, I just want to show you my farm and my coffee and my workers. And I said, yeah, but we're supposed to go to the co-op. We're meeting with these farmers to help them form a co-op. So I had to go through the dog and pony show. And we show up there and I said, I'm sorry, I can't buy your coffee. I only buy coffee from cooperatives because that's the way to help people raise their standard of living up. And he goes, no, that's fine. But he was really angry at me because yes. I didn't go for it. And, yeah. he was unaccustomed to business people coming yeah. in and not buying into the corruption that frankly is rampant in Kenya.
Did you have to get
places,
out
of but Kenya? That was my personal experience.
Did you have to get out of Kenya in the end?
I did get out of Kenya. And I wrote about this in Java Trekker, my first book. I wrote the episode up and even put the picture of the guy in there. And when I went to the next year's coffee conference, international coffee conference, the Kenyan farmers who were there said, Mr. Dean, the minister is here. I was like, uh-oh. And I see him and he looks at me, calls me over. I was like, oh, this is going to be uncomfortable. And he wants to take a picture with me with the book. And I'm just, what's going on here? Afterwards, the farmers walked me back to where I was standing, and they were like, oh, that's so funny. I said, but he must be so angry. And they said, he doesn't read.
Oh!
He just saw a book with his picture in it and you standing next to him. And he thought, oh, this is great. But he didn't read it. He doesn't read.
Oh, my God.
So I got away with it.
You know, you talked about self-esteem, and I'm willing to bet, I'd like to hear more about that, but did you see transformations in self?
I can't tell you how many times. So remember, I'm doing this 30 years, and the problem with most coffee companies and the problem with trying to do anything in terms of change in coffee is that companies generally, they buy from this group 1 year, they buy from that group the next year, they don't have relationships. So they don't know what's happening with their money in their name in those villages. Mm-hmm. But I have relationships. I've been working with one cooperative for 28 years. So I started with, you know, with the parents and then the kids, and now the grandchildren are growing up and running their family farms. So I can see the multi-generational impact of our work together. Now, you know, we're not changing the whole world, but we're really having an impact in our sphere. And I think that that's the key to change, is not to bite off more than you can chew. You know, if you think you're going to change climate change, you know, blah, 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 no. But you can change it in your own company. You can work with other companies for them to change their piece. And as Tolstoy once said, your role isn't to be the blazing sun. It's to add your light to the sum of lights. So that's how I see my role. And that's how I see the role of change agents. So, yes, I'll give you one great example. In 2003, I was at a coffee conference and I was approached by a small group of Peruvian farmers. And as usual, what they do is they come up with this little plastic baggie with unroasted coffee in it. And they say, please, here's a sample of our coffee. Would you try it? And most people, just to be polite, take it and then leave it in their hotel room because, you know, I don't know who these people are and I only deal with big brokers. So I talked to them a little bit and I heard their story. I said, I only buy from cooperatives. And they're like, we're a cooperative. We've been a cooperative for 10 years. I was like, oh. I said, I only buy organic. And I was like, well, we're organic. We've been organic for 5 years. And I said, really? How much coffee do you sell internationally? And they said, none. And I was like, wow, you've got all the right qualifications. What's going on? So after talking to them, I said, you know what? I'm going to take a chance with you. I'll buy a container of your coffee at fair trade prices and we'll see what happens.
Is fair trade price, by the way?
Okay, fair trade, oh boy, that's a whole conversation. But basically, there's an international market price. It's called the C price, which is a commodity price. The C price, like all commodity prices, goes up and down every day, depending on whether there's been a frost in Brazil, you know, which limits the coffee, which means the price goes up, right? Lower supply, greater demand. Or there's a rumor that the war in Colombia is going to end. What does that mean? More coffee is going to get onto the market. Oh, more coffee, greater supply for the same demand, the price goes down. So coffee farmers up in the mountains are growing their coffee and they don't know about all this stuff. So they come down the mountain with a bag of coffee and there's a intermediary at the bottom of the, with his pickup truck. And he says, okay, I'll buy your coffee today for 30 cents a pound. And I go, wait a minute. Last week it was 60 cents a pound. It's the same coffee, the same bag. It just took me that long to get back down from the mountain. And the guy says, sorry, that's the world market price today. So it's totally out of the farmer's control. In fair trade, there are a number of conditions. One, the farmers have to be organized into a democratic cooperative that has its own power of organizing and education and allows these small farmers, instead of selling one bag to an intermediary, it allows the farmers to collect their coffee together and be able to access the international market directly, going past all these intermediaries. So that's on the farmer's side. On the buyer's side, we promise always to pay at least the minimum price that fair trade requires, which is generally, right now, it just went up actually, but it's been about, for organics, $1.90 a pound. Now, a couple of years ago, the world trade price got down to 65 cents a pound. So you can see the difference it makes in helping farmers stay on their land and feed their kids. It's profound. So when I bought that first container from Pangoa in Peru, at the time it was $1.65 or something like that. We paid the $1.65. They've been selling coffee for 35 to 55 cents to exporters, right, and on the local market. So we basically tripled their income. And what a difference that made. The first thing they did, they started a women's loan fund so local women could generate more income out of their houses. We're still working with that women's loan fund 20 years later. Okay. Now, Esperanza, who was the general manager of that co-op, is now one of the leading women in the international movement for gender equity in farming life and also for trade justice. And I've seen her go boom, boom, boom from this shy, you know, woman, you know, asking me to buy her little bag of coffee to being a powerhouse on the world stage. She also trains other women to become leaders in the coffee communities. Yeah. So, you know, add your light to the sum of lights. That's it.
But I just want to stay with this theme of self-respect and of self-esteem, because I'm guessing that you have about 16 employees now. Is that?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And you're late, which we'll get to your retirement plans. But while the company was running, did you also make an effort to sort of give them extra benefits that they might not have gotten at another coffee place, for example?
So we've had a pension plan, which nobody has anymore.
Nobody.
We turned that into a really muscular 401k plan when we just got so many employees for our little company that we couldn't even fund the pension plan. So we turn that into a 401k plan. And what we do with that is we give them 5% of their salary in the 401k plan, regardless of whether they put anything in or not. We encourage them to do so, but you know, even if they're struggling and they can't because they're buying a house now or right. They just had a kid. So that's a guaranteed 5% every year over time. You know, that really, really grows. We have quarterly profit sharing and bonuses every quarter, like clockwork. We have full health care. Now, for your international viewers, that, you know, in places where the government is more active in healthcare, that may not sound like something, but this is the United States we're talking about. And what we have is we pay 100% of the premium every month. We pay 100% of the deductible that you have to pay before the benefits kick in.
Non-Americans don't even have any idea what a deductible is.
Listen, it took me years to understand this, and I still have to refresh it in my mind. So there's three levels, right? You pay the premium, you have to pay the deductible before you start to get any actual benefits, but then you have to pay what's called the out-of-pocket before you actually get serious health care, right? We pay all of that, not only for the individuals, but for their families. That is a benefit that can be $30,000, $40,000 a year. When someone has a baby, you know, in other countries, it doesn't cost anything sometimes. In America, it costs, even with healthcare.
How much time do women take off when they have a baby?
Well, we have a three-month paid maternity leave and a one-month paid paternity leave.
Excellent. Okay.
But now Massachusetts, we were also very active in legislation in both on the local and national level. We do a lot of lobbying, and we lobbied for a thing called the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act and also the Paid Family Sick Leave Act. So what that means in Massachusetts is that a woman who gives birth can have, oh my God, is it 6 months, maybe 9 months even, that we're required to keep them on the books, and the government gives them a stipend, but we also give them a stipend. We don't have to, but we do. So it allows people to take really long periods of time with a guarantee that their job is going to be there with an income that can support their family.
Yeah.
So that's a major benefit.
I want to start crying. I mean, I ended up moving to the Netherlands in large measure because I had a pre-existing condition.
Yeah.
And it was costing me so much money for healthcare that I ended up fleeing the country. And it was only after I got into a country where healthcare was reasonable that I realized how stressful and sad my life had been. And so you're giving back so much to your employees. But now, perhaps the most interesting is you've decided at 70 to finally retire, or I don't even want to say retire, but to give up the...
To rewire. I'm going to rewire.
I love it. You've decided to sell your business. And from what I understand, you originally did consider various people that wanted to buy it. And tell me what you decided. Tell the viewers what you decided.
So originally, you know, I always wanted to make sure that Dean's Beans stayed on mission. We have a beautiful thing going on, a unique thing that serves everybody. So why rock the boat? You know, so I said, well, what can I do to enshrine the mission going forward? I talked to some, you know, progressive business people, and they say, Dean, you know, business is like a house. When you sell it, you got to forget about it. And I thought, maybe you want to do that, but I don't. This thing is more than a business to me. It's a lifestyle. It's a mission. So I looked at different ways that I could embed the mission, like creating a voting trust, which Patagonia just did. I've been talking about it for 16 years. They took the votes and they said, okay, if you want to buy a share of stock, you can buy a share of stock, but we're going to take the right to vote and put that in a voting trust so that the voting trust controls the mission, so that you're not getting in it to strip it out of assets and sell it off piece by piece like a lot of venture capitalists do, but rather you're in it because you believe in it, you know, and you think you're going to make money, but you believe in it. It's a new wave of investing, right? So I tried thinking about that. It's clunky, this and that. Anyway, I was approached by a number of very, you know, very good people I've known in different businesses and law, about the possibility of buying Dean's Beans and keeping it on mission. And I was like, great. So I'd start to have these conversations with folks. And the deeper I got, you know, there's my lawyer training, right? The deeper I got, the more it was really about money at the end of the day. They liked feeling good about Dean's Beans because everybody loves Dean's Beans. But at the end of the day, they were like, you know, how can I increase my income? And can I bring four or five of my buddies from this other company aboard? And how are we going to make room for that? And I said, well, the only way to make room for all your friends and to increase the money you're going to get is what? You have to increase sales. To increase sales, you have to hire more salespeople. So there's an expense. To increase sales, you have to get more machinery. Big expense. And maybe you have to get another building or expand the building. Major expense. So now you've taken on all this debt so that you can achieve your greater goals. And right now you've got a company that has no debt, is totally positioned for growth and happiness in the future. Why rock the boat? Because they're thinking about making more money, you know? So those people were out. And unfortunately, that's been the way for what I call progressive founders for a long time. Now I'm talking about Ben and Jerry's, I'm talking about Stonyfield Yogurt, Honest Tea, Tom's of Maine, all these companies that your American audiences at least will know are the champion progressive companies. So, you know, founded by one or two people. Burt's Bees is another one. At the end of the day, what happens to the founders when they start to look like me? They start thinking, they're not thinking legacy, they're thinking money. And every single one of them has sold to a multinational corporation, which promises, they all promise, we're going to keep the mission, we're going to keep everything the same. So, and I know that that's just not how the corporate world works. It's not that it's evil, it's the culture. The culture is to turn it into the money-making machine that they want it to be. Okay, that's fine. If those are your values, acknowledge them, and there we go. Now we can all live our lives honestly. But what happens is every single one of those companies, oh, maybe it takes 5 years, but eventually they change. I'll give you a perfect example. Tom's of Maine, okay, they are so known for having organic and all natural products. So they got bought by Colgate, you know, like P&G, right? Big international company. So I noticed that it didn't change for a while, but now their all natural deodorant, which I use, contains aluminum, which is sort of the big bad element, you know, on putting on your body because it's been associated with Alzheimer's over time and all sorts of things. So they never had aluminum in there because they said, we don't do that. We're an all natural company. But I just noticed on their new packaging, there it is. And it's so small, you can't see it. It used to say on the front of the package, no aluminum. Now it doesn't say that. And there it is, aluminum buried right in there. So that's an example of how these things happen.
What you ultimately did was decide to give your company to the employees, right?
Well, who else better both to keep the mission going on and who deserves it more? Yeah. You know, because some of the employees came up to me and said, Dean, if you sell to these guys, well, what'll happen if they cut our benefits? I was like, what happens if they fire this guy or that guy or what, you know, what'll you do? And I said, if I do this, I won't be able to do anything. And that'll change everything. And then I'll feel awful, you know, totally betrayed. So I said, you know what? I can't do this. The only people who deserve this and will really hold to the mission are the employees.
How do they pay you? How do you get paid for the business?
Interesting. So first off, I'm selling it to them at 50% of what it's been valued at, because I don't want them to be so encumbered with debt that it's hard for them to carry on. That's one. Okay. Two, you know, I've been doing this for 30 years. In my world, I don't need the money that bad, you know? So it's like, once again, you know, how much is enough? I got enough.
Are you going to keep some shares as well, though, for yourself?
Like, shares?
Yeah.
No. It's all theirs. I'm going to stay on the board of directors for a couple of years to mentor, you know, until they tell me, go sailing and write books. But anyway, so what's happening is a bank that funds cooperatives is coming in to lend them the money. 2/3 of the money, the bank is lending them, and 1/3 I'm giving, they're giving me a note for 1/3, okay, at better terms than the bank even. Okay. So that it'll be basically my leaving freeze up enough money to service my note. So it's basically like I'm just getting paid still without the benefits, without all the extra benefits. And the bank, we generate enough cash flow that can pay the note to the bank. So I said to the employees, I know it's scary. You've never owned a business. And we've done a lot of training in the last 8 months on business management, financial literacy. But I said, think about it this way. You're actually not spending anything out of your life except, you know, a $5,000 down payment on the shares, which you'll get back in a year of profit sharing. But you're going to own this company without actually paying for it, right? The business will have debt, but the business can pay the debt without you having to kick in anything. It's such a gift, and they know it and appreciate it.
Beautiful story. I feel so bad. We're already out of time. I have to mention that on top of everything, you managed to write a book called Coming Home, which is really based on a Holocaust survivor trying to come back after the war, right? To his,
I don't know. It's a very little known story. I was doing research on something else, and I came upon this story of some survivors of Auschwitz going back to their hometown, only to find out that their homes and their businesses are all owned by their former neighbors and friends.
Dean, did you know that my mother is a Holocaust survivor? We were in Auschwitz briefly. They were in a series of labor camps. And after the war, my grandmother tried to go home to get her jewelry, and she was beat up by Russian soldiers. Everything was stolen. And it's my story. And
it is your story.
And I tried to go back. I did go back to the house years later to see it. But I have to, I'm going to stop there only because we're out of time. But I'm going to put a link to your book and to the reviews. And I think it is just so fascinating that you've taken up this world as an author and talking about something that's so meaningful to you. And just your whole life has been fascinating. So I can't thank you enough for...
Well, I've been blessed to have tons of opportunity, and I'm grateful that I've had the intelligence and the courage to go after it, because it's both luck and skill and grit. You know, the brand called you. You know, you gotta have all that stuff to be successful.
You have all that stuff.
Yeah, and, I'm doing all right.
I can't wait to read about and follow up on your next chapter, which I inevitably will be something very exciting.
I'm sure. I've already got stuff in the works.
Oh, I can't wait. Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lisa. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.